Hey, welcome to Season 3 of Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also on the Internet Archive, archive.org, and a number of podcast platforms. Yes, and that. If you missed any of our previous shows, ranging from Brian Redman, Judy Strobus, Rob Dyson, Chris Cobb, and John Doonan, to GTU, Lamar, and racing authors, they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com. And on the podcasts, from iHeartRadio Podcast, Google, Amazon, Spotify, now reaching millions of fans. Download the app and listen on your phone, car radio, or computer. Ha! We're starting off the year with a very special event, a discussion of the legendary Riverside Raceway, the track on the edge of the California desert that from 1957 to 1989 hosted sports cars, stock cars, motorcycles, go-karts, drag racing, Indy cars, Formula 5000, and once even Formula One. Tonight's show features, in no particular order, Dave Wallen, our producer and author of the massive two-volume book set, Riverside. Stock car racer, Duke Hohenschau, whose victories include the LA 200, precursor to the Cup race in 1985. Journalist Bill Phillips, who turned laps around the track with Bobby Allison. Yippee! I like that. John Norris, who competed there in club racing, IMSA, RS, and Renault Cup, and a few other series. Jeff Klein, the club racer turned pro, who ran in Trans Am and IMSA. Rick Newt, who drove in IMSA GTU and GTP. Rod Bean, longtime club racer, corner worker extraordinary. John Dillon, who wrote the memorable hit song, Darryl Waltrip Tried to Kill Me in Turn 6. I'm sorry I missed that. I need a tape. Paul Decal Kelly, fueler to the stars, whose IMSA record for refueling race cars is unsurpassed. And Victor Van Tress, corner worker, racer, and SCCA national champ in a Peugeot. So, audience, fasten your seat belts and please mute your phones. Have a question? Just send it via chat and our producer will pass it along. Welcome to all you racers and folks out in the ether. Thanks for joining us tonight. It's the largest panel our show has ever had. I'll try to keep you all straight, but I probably won't. So I'll ask you each to identify yourselves each time you begin to speak or make a comment so we can all keep up with you. A scorecard. All right. I'm going to open the trap door to the Wayback Machine with a memory from my boss, the usually reclusive Jim Dowding, about his first memory of Riverside. He recalled driving to the track from Atlanta to compete in the first SCCA runoffs in 1964. He'd probably just gotten out of Georgia Tech. He was with one friend who was his only crewman, pulling a Formula V on a flatbed behind Jim's multicolored souped-up funeral hearse. I'm dying to see a picture of that. He started from the pole but finished 10th. In 1978, he won at Riverside in the RF class, driving an RX-3. And again in 1986 in his mighty Mazda Argo in Camel Lights. So, I hope you're all inspired. Now for some Riverside recollections. Take it away, Dave.
Well, thanks. Happy birthday there to Jim Dowding, who passed me an awful lot in his RX-3. We'll start this off with a little commercial for you folks in the audience. If you haven't bought my two-volume book about Riverside, you should buy it. It's available on Amazon and eBay and at the RacingHistoryProject.com website. And all these people are mentioned in the book. Let's start this off with Bill Phillips, who has a good story to tell.
Well, I was pretty – I covered racing at Riverside from 1970 till 79, pretty much every race that was there. So I was lucky. I saw a lot of fun stuff. I also wrote for a couple of newspapers that didn't, you know, couldn't afford to send people out to California to cover the NASCAR races. So I did some writing that way. I made big $15 a story, by the way.
Woo.
Wow.
I'm not going to call the
McDonald's anymore.
Now, Bill, how about that ride with Bobby Allison?
Yeah, that was one time I was out there. Luckily, I have the pictures to prove it. I got kind of friendly with Bobby Allison in the early 70s. And one day, it was the day before they were practicing. And I don't know, I kind of half-assed him. He said, hey, what's the chance of getting a ride, you know, like that? And he said, well, you know, we're testing some stuff out tomorrow. If you showed up about noon, I think we could do it. Well, naturally, I was there. And we waited a while, and I got in the car. This is when he was driving Roger Penske's Matador. And I get in, he waves me into the car. Now, I'm sitting in this car. I'm sitting on an orange crate, no helmet, no seatbelt. I'm holding onto the roll bars. And down in the passenger side, there's a little pressure keg down there. And he says, see that? That's our power brakes. If you kick that, we die. And I got to run about two laps around the track. And I asked him later, I said, how fast were we going? And he said, well, down that backstretch, we were going about 190. And at first, it didn't feel like it because that's what that car is built to do. But, man, he swung that thing up into turn nine and threw myself up against the side of the car, and I knew we were going fast. But that was a real experience.
I bet it was.
Stock cars,
and most of you guys know this, the majority of races held at Riverside, over 50, were NASCAR stock car races. For a long time, the opening race of the NASCAR season was at Riverside, so they decided to move it to Daytona. And so talking about stock cars, Duke Henschel has not only a story, he actually won some there. So Duke, tell us a brief story about your experiences at the track.
Well, I was on a pit crew that went there a couple years before we went there our first time. So we put the car together and used what I'd learned on the pit crew and gave it a shot in 1977. So we worked our tail off out there, and a lot of that division, that sportsman division, all into the NASCAR Southwest Tour. So went along and all with it and doing, had success.
Now, there was a story, I think, that Buddy Baker told that had said he had been there 10 times before he realized that there were any corners between turn one and turn six. When you were driving the course in a stock car, did you stay on the pavement, or did you straighten the road out and run flat out to six?
Well, when we had the old Chevelle, you'd cut the corners for sure. But once we started building our own cars and went to the tube frame and that, I kept it on the track. That was just it. I needed, that's what I had to do.
Makes sense to me. Hey, Jeff Klein, when was the first time you went to Riverside? Are you there, Jeff Klein?
Here I am.
Ed,
I'm here.
When was the first time you went to Riverside?
1961. I just started my senior year in high school after moving here from Pennsylvania, and a buddy and I went out there and watched the Times Grand Prix, and I was hooked. I remember watching it from turn five because we couldn't afford grandstand seats up in turn six, and it was pretty mind-blowing, and I decided I was going to go racing, and then in 1965, I took driver's school at Riverside in my Lotus Super 7 that I bought while I was away in the Army at Fort Sill. And I probably did 30, 35 club races at Riverside, and then I think 12 pro races, and one there in Camel Light, and I won with Jack Baldwin in 85 and with Jack Dunham in 84. in GTU. So I drove GTU cars. I drove GTP Light, and then unfortunately 87 was the last year, but one of my favorite racetracks. I drove two Trans Am races there, and one in Alpha GTA 1300cc. I finished seventh. And then once in a BMW that at the end of the race, I had 3 inches of oil at my feet. So it was kind of fun. But I've driven a lot of cars at Riverside and really, really miss it. It's a spectacular track. And if I remember correctly, and I think it was 89, part of the track was still left, and I went out there and tested the 300ZX turbo for Clayton Cunningham at the abbreviated track. You went up to turn 6, and then you straight line 7 and went back to turn 9 and then went through the S's to turn 6. It was kind of weird, but that was all that was left at the track by then. So Riverside is a spectacular place.
It wasn't pretty, but it did the job. Everybody loved it.
My wife said something today. I told her, she said, what's the subject there? And I said, Riverside. And she said, well, you could tell any of the listeners whose wives miss Riverside to go on the hottest day they can and stand in the parking lot of a supermarket and watch the cars go by, and they can get Riverside, you know? That's right.
And Dusty.
Tragic. Oh, that's horrible.
And Dusty. Yeah, that's Riverside.
Hey, this is Bill. You guys mentioned Buddy Baker a few minutes ago. Reminded me of a story. I can't remember the year. It was about 73, 74. Buddy Baker drove a second team car for the Petties at Riverside. I think it was number 11, a white Charger. And naturally, in practice, he spun it around. I think he hit the wall up in sixth. And I happened to be standing by Dale Inman, Richard Petty's crew chief, and he says, you give Buddy Baker an anvil by noon, and he'll have it broken. He didn't like road
Well, a lot of them didn't. Oh, funny.
Yeah, actually, Trish, have you got a Riverside story? You were there a few times.
Hot. Dusty. I had the crunchiest sandwiches ever because it was just felt like it was all full. Everything was full of sand. I wasn't doing. I didn't have a whole lot to do. I didn't time and score those.
Anyway, while you're
driving,
some of these folks are standing out on those hot and dusty corners. Guys like John Dillon, tell us about that.
Yeah, the track, by the time I got involved with flagging, was already starting to decline. They were planning on closing it. It was 88. But, you know, we always joked about the mystery meat sandwiches where, you know, the bread was green and the meat was brown. Or the other way around. It was kind of strange, but
mine were better than that.
Yeah. But you know, for some of us, we were there because of the people. It was you know, met some wonderful folks, and when I started flagging, I was meeting everyone from architects and engine builders to librarians and so many different interesting people out there on the corners with us. And we all shared the passion for cars, but it was the people that kept me coming back all those years.
And Decal, Paul Kelly, you've been to Riverside
hey.
A lot. Tell the audience and our fans out there a little bit about your background in racing and maybe your Riverside story.
Well, I started racing in about 73, and I finally got to Riverside in 79, and for me, it was an absolute thrill to go there, because being from the East Coast, I had always heard about these things, I had seen all the film of this place, and it was such an icon, and it was such a historic place, I always wanted to go there. I finally got to go there in 79, and I just walked out on the pit lane, and just started looking around, I was actually memorized, like, you know, I'm here, I'm actually at Riverside, well, I'm actually going to race here. And I think I came back out there about seven or eight more times throughout the years. For the 6-hour race, I think I did one Trans Am with a guy with Phil Kern. And it was really a thrill. I mean, yeah, fine. There at the end, it was a dilapidated place, and it really needed, you know, I just wish somebody had come in with $1 billion and upgraded the place. It was a fantastic track, you know, the layout of it. And just, you know, but the one memory I got is actually kind of a bad memory. Tony Adamowicz was driving the Conti Lola, and I was working on the Sauber GTP car, and they took each other out at turn one. And some, I mean, he, you know, turn one, yeah, he hit that wall hard, as in, like, knocked it out, knocked it. And the other thing I could think of was, there goes my trip to Le Mans. We were supposed to take the Sauber to Le Mans about 3 weeks later, and it was like, well, so much for that trip. So, yeah, I mean, I loved Riverside. I really did. You know, Dave, I got a couple of questions for you later on about one particular race. I'll talk to you later on about it, all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
You want me to ask you now? Or I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, well, hang on. We'll get back to you. And by the way, okay. Dave, let me say that Paul and Vital Kelly is a few words of the stars, and over the last 30 years, I don't know how many different race teams he fueled for, but he was certainly responsible for a lot of my successes in 24-hour races. He was out there every hour and a half with a 75-pound can of fuel on his shoulder going to Mitsubishi or two, and we couldn't have done it without you, Paul. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Victor Van Tress, are you around there somewhere?
I am around. Still.
Yeah. You were a corner worker and a racer. Tell us about how you got into racing by being a corner worker.
I can combine the two, actually. I don't know if I've told this story before, but I was racing a Mustang in Jerome Stock A, and it broke. And I pulled into turn 7A, and I got out of the car, walked over to flag station. Donnie Albright, he knew it was me. He handed me a blue flag. So I started blue flagging the traffic as it was coming by. And John Norris is the only person, I think, that recognized that a driver was actually manning the blue flag at the time. But I cover 71 to 70, about 78 as a quarter worker, 79 and 80 as a regional driver, and then 81 to 89 as a national driver. So I got a lot of laps in there, but there was always good stuff. There was, you know, barbecues and, you know, after the races, we went up to the Turn 6 grandstands, and Wolfman Jack was introducing the bands, and they introduced some German Moomba band or something, and everybody blew the hell out of that. And he walked out, he said, okay, and then he brought out the rock and roll bands. But so German-American relationships got a big hit on that particular night. But, you know, corner working, you know, you're only working, like the man said, the mystery meat sandwiches. You know, you're working for nothing. And then I think it was Duborg that became a sponsor of the series. And it was terrible. Nobody would drink that. And so we go to the beer bust and send somebody to the liquor store to go get some Budweiser. You know, that's all we were working for was the beer bust at the end of the day. Anyway, and they stuck us with some beer that we couldn't even drink again. Oh, God. I missed the place. Oh, by the way, I wanted to throw this one thing in there. If you go to Google Maps right now, you will see Turn 9 still exists. The last part of it. It's still there. Just part of it. The last part of Turn 9. It's there.
Well, and by the way, I got a question here from the audience from Rick Newt. the audience here says you drove a 962 in some of the last IMSA races there at Riverside. What was it like driving a 962, and how fast did it go?
Well, we had a two-car field. The year was 1985, and it was with Jim Busby Racing, the BF Goodrich cars. We were fortunate enough to finish first and second, and we considered Riverside sort of our home track because Jim and I had been hooked up for a number of years, and the shop, as you know, has been there since 74. So it was a big win for us. I the speed would be on the back chute, I would imagine somewhere between 185 and maybe 193, close to 200. The cars, we were running the longer course, as you all know, which would take you almost to the freeway at turn 7. And then you'd get with it, and those cars had a good index of performance or power to weight. And it was awfully rewarding for the LA Times 6 hour to have John Morton was driving the 68 car along with Pete Halsmer, and I was driving 67. I had corporate orders. They got on and said, nope, you've got to finish second, because I had done well at some races and their car was misfiring. So that was, you do what you got to do, because you know, it's a real privilege to drive these cars, and that's the story of 1985.
That's another question from the audience, actually, about speed. Probably a good question for you, Duke. How fast were the stock cars running down the back straight there?
I'm figuring we were doing at least 170. We were flat out flying, and it was always a thrill to go through that dog leg flat out and then start thinking about how to get through 9. But it was just so cool to turn a car at 170 miles an hour.
This is Bill. I got a question. Was the speed going under the Champion Bridge, was that about when you hit maximum speed, or was it closer to turn 9?
I think we were rung out shortly after that, you know. It was, you had to have enough gear in it to give you the giddy up in the turns and the slow stuff. So we just had to roll back to keep from over revving it.
Well, they're talking about speed. For Jeff Klein, you might chime in here. How fast did you go with some of those GTP cars?
Well, the GTP light, I never got to drive a GTP car at Riverside, but the GTP light cars were probably 165, 170, probably high 160s. And a GTU car was probably in the high 150s. I could be wrong. They never told us how fast we were going, because they probably didn't want to scare us. But, you know, going through turn, the kink was in a sports car was a no-brainer. You didn't even have to think about it. I have respect for a guy in a 3,600-pound stock car having to go through that with all that momentum. But with a sports car, it was pretty easy. And then turn 9 was just down one gear, and midway through turn 9, you back flat on it. And turn 1 was virtually flat. The S's was flat. So it was a real high-speed course for those cars.
I was interested. I seem to be fascinated with speed here tonight. All I know is that in my RX3 at 140 going into turn 9, I was terrified. But that might have been
just shows you were doing it right, yeah.
This is Bill. You were asking about memorable moments. My first race covering it as a reporter was the 1972 Borg 400 NASCAR race. That's when they had the wind cars, and the front row was Petty and Allison. And the race started, and they're side by side, and they head up as they get up the top of turn 6. Going through the S's, all of a sudden there was a cloud of dust. You couldn't see anything. And then finally, the dust settled, and then you can see that big blue Plymouth of Petty's going over turn six, and Allison was spun out onto the side. And he went on to win the race, and they asked him what happened down there in turn one in the press interview. And Richard said, well, me and Bobby both got down there at the same time, and I knew there was only room for one of us, and it was going to be me.
Probably everybody had some kind of instances of going through the issues there anyway. Hey, Detail, finish your story there. What was the rest of the story you had to tell?
In the mid-60s, there was a Can-Am race or a USRC race, considered to be the greatest assembly talent ever, you know, for a race. I think Jim Clark was there, Graham Hill, Donahue, AJ, Mario. I forget if it was his, I know it was the Los Angeles Times Grand Prix. Can't remember the year. I was always kind of curious if you were involved in that race, because you drove back then.
I don't think Jim was old enough, actually.
what year was that?
That USRC you're talking about was probably 1965. Clark had a third in the Lotus 40, and Graham Hill was there in one McLaren, and so on and so on. It was a big deal.
And over the RC or one of the first Can-Am races? Couldn't remember where it was. I remember talking to Oscar about that, and he said that, you know, you look at that field, and this was Riverside. Riverside always brought out the very, very best drivers and mechanics. You know, if you were holding a race at Riverside, you know the big names, the big guns were going to be there. And that was just one I always was kind of curious if you actually drove in that one or not.
I actually didn't move to California until 1968, but Jeff Klein might have been there in a supporting race.
I went to all those races. I was there. I wouldn't miss it.
You know, for those in the audience who hadn't seen this stuff, the U.S. Road Racing Championship was actually probably better than the Can-Am in terms of diversity of cars and drivers. But it got overshadowed by the big money in the Can-Am and the last USRC race, actually, in 1968, when SCCA kind of got put out of business by the Can-Am folks and went from there. But anybody who went to a Can-Am and saw these 1,000-horsepower monsters thundering down the back straight, maybe standing on the bridge there watching them go by, boy, that was an experience.
Yeah, they were pretty amazing. I think... They always had regional races, you know, that accompanied those races for all the, I guess the Placate Cow Club. So it was always fun to go out there in a TR4 or a Super 7 or whatever I was driving at the time and then watch the real people race, you know. It was pretty spectacular. And, you know, what was amazing is that they got hundreds of thousands of people out to the Times Grand Prix and stuff. Even with IMSA was racing, I mean, we had a big crowd. And now you look at some of the IMSA races, not to make them minimalize them, but they get hardly any people out for those things. I don't know what the deal is. I don't think people can relate to it or something.
Television had a lot to do with that. And certainly IMSA races, the stock car shows, everything had 50,000, 60,000, 70,000 people every weekend. And it was the same all over the country. I was at races at Watkins Glen when there were 80,000 people. At Mossport when there were 75,000 people. But television took a lot of that away. Kind of the demise of Ontario was part of that television that had just come along at that time. And after you raced in a televised event and watched it on TV, you realized that spectators didn't get to see the show the way you did on television. So,
that's funny. Trish, at the beginning of this, Trish asked if anyone was going to Daytona. And I guess Decal's the only person, but I'd rather watch it on TV because I can see it better, you know?
So. Well, for everybody who went to Riverside, and you all hit it right on the button there, it was always hot or cold. It snowed one time. If you had a car in the parking lot, at the end of the day, it was beige because everything was covered with dust. The smog was sometimes so bad you couldn't see turn one. and yet it was one of the greatest racetracks to drive on anywhere in the world, no question about it. But today, when you watch, as we upcoming in Daytona, for example, on television, you get to see things you couldn't see if you were there as a driver or as a spectator. And I can remember, and you guys probably did the same, driving around from one corner to another, watching here for a while, going somewhere else. We're always in the wrong place where all the action was, it seemed. Now on TV, even though they do a terrible job sometimes, it's the way to go, and therefore the spectators don't matter very much. It's just a sad case.
Well, I have a question. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Speaking about the smog. The smog at Riverside, I remember one of the second or third times I was out there, and it was a windy day, and I was shocked to see north of the track that there's a big mountain there. Because you could never see it most of the time.
Hey, this is Bill again. If somebody was talking about the great road racers out there, a lot of people don't remember the first IROC race was at Riverside when they all had Porsche Carreras. And I remember Donahue, Redson, Bobby Unger, Pearson, George Fulmer, A.J. Foyt, Emerson Fittipaldi, Allison Petty, Gordon John Cock, and a couple others that I can't remember name, but that was a pretty exciting. You don't get many better road racers than those guys.
Yeah, they put on a good show in the IROC show, no question about it. Bobby Allison actually told me a story where he bought a Porsche to drive around at home to learn a little bit about driving them. And then during that IROC race, something happened. The car didn't run very well or something. He was mad, went home, sold the Porsche, never going to drive another one trip.
I think those were Penske-prepared cars, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, they were all built by Penske, by Jason Urey, actually, yeah.
Milt Minner did the setup work on those cars. He set all those cars up.
Milt and Kenny Schrader still around doing stuff. That's where you have
a piece of work.
Duke, you must have some stories about racing against some of these other guys. Man, yeah, maybe we lost him. There was Victor, you still around?
Yeah.
You got to drive in a lot of different categories. Among other things, I know you drove one of my trucks once and you ran in the Renault Cup. We did a show on the Renault Cup a couple years ago, actually, because it was kind of a fun show. But you got a Renault Cup story?
Well, you know, you got a 56 horsepower car, and you got 60 people in the field, and they qualify within a quarter of a second of each other from front to back. So it's a real, it's a tough race. And I remember going into turn 9, you were talking about, you know, how fast you go into turn 9. Well, if you bump draft, which means you hit the car in front of you, and you got five cars in a row, and everybody's bumping into their back bumpers, the Renault could go maybe about 10 miles an hour faster into turn 9 than it would normally. Now, be advised, that's probably about 85 miles an hour. But I'm telling you, it was hard racing. You really had to work hard. And I remember one thing, you know, everybody's like within a quarter inch of one another. We're going around turn 6, and somebody misses a shift. And so you hit him, and then there's this repercussion, you know, like an accordion going backwards, and everybody's bumping into each other. It was a lot of fun. We had a good time with it. Wasn't going fast, but it was really close racing. And I know the spectators liked it. In fact, I had heard that all the mechanics would drop their tools and go to the pit straight to watch a Renault Cup race because it was more exciting than anything else. Didn't go real fast, but it was exciting.
John Dillon here with a bump drafting story.
Yeah.
The my very first race was a sport truck race, SCCA sport truck thing at Riverside. And it we were told in our morning meeting that bump drafting was frowned upon as contact, but if it happened between teammates, it was okay. And the difference between bump drafting and actual contact or hitting someone was whether or not their helmet snapped back. And I'm thinking, how am I going to tell from turn two whether that driver's helmet has snapped back or if he's just always sitting like that? But it was just like the Renaults. You know, they were nose to tail, and they may not have been the fastest vehicles out there, but they were absolutely entertaining. And part of the challenge of flagging was to focus on the flagging and not the racing. You got to pay attention to, you know, potential blue flags coming up or yellow flags over your shoulder. And fortunately, we had a good-sized team in those days. But you really had to pay attention, and you couldn't just, you know, pivot your head to watch, you know, did so-and-so make the pass or not.
I remember, if I can jump in here, I remember the first time I flagged. First time I flagged was a Porsche time trial, I think. And I was the guy that was pulling the strings in turn two, driver's right. And they had these things called pop-up flags. And you would pull the string, and the flag would jump up. And that's how you communicated with the driver. First car that comes through turn two runs over all that stuff. So I sat up there in the booth and just watched the cars go round and round and round. They had tires in two and three and five. And man, you don't cut a corner when you're running over a tire. It's pretty brutal. Yeah. And then what was the other thing? Oh, I flagged. I was in the entry of seven, and I flagged when it was snowing. And Formula Atlantic race, Formula B, well, they would come flying in there, and there's snow everywhere. And about the whole field went off at turn seven. So we were waving, you know, a yellow flag, but there was nobody to tell it to because they were all piled up down there in the bottom of seven. We had a lot of times like that. In fact, in that race, there one guy was a guy named Steve Saline. He was called Gasoline at the time, and that's the Steve Saline that made the Saline Mustangs and all that. So he went on to greater things, I guess.
Yeah, he did. Another question from the audience here for Jeff Klein. You said you had run in some Trans Am. What Trans Am races did you run in? What kind of cars, et cetera?
1970, the under 2.5 liter. I was driving my Alpha GTA Junior, but it had a 1300 engine instead of the bigger engine. And I finished seventh. And then in 71, I drove a BMW 2002 that my friend Joel Martin, who was one of the crew guys on the High Park Motors BMW, set me up with a guy who had a kind of raggedy 2002. But I was happy to be there and drove that. And I think we finished in the top 10 anyway. And I was just happy to be there. Psyched, in fact. I was happier than the heck. So that was the two Trans Ams that I ran. And then in 75, I drove the six-hour race, IMSA race they had there. And it was my first professional race with Chris Cord. And it was his first professional race, too. And we drove a Ferrari Daytona that was prepared by Modena Sports Cars, a guy named Bruno Bori. I think we finished 15th. It was interesting, though. If you remember that race, the BMW CSLs, the Batmobiles were in it. And about every 12 or 15 minutes, they'd lap me. And I could keep up with them going down the straight. And then at turn nine, they'd outbrake me, and I'd never see them again for another 15 or 20 minutes. But that was a fun race. That was a good time. So that was my first professional race, and same with Chris Cord. And Chris Cord went on to, you know, everyone knows Chris Cord. He passed away in 2022. Great guy. super guy, in fact, you know. So anyway, that's my Trans Am experience, which is kind of frustrating because in 1970 at the runoffs at Atlanta, Pete Brock told me I was going to be Sean Morton's teammate in 1971 if I could win the race. And then he could sell me to Nissan or Datsun at the time. And unfortunately, on the last lap, I was on the pole. I led the whole race. And on the last lap, the engine broke, and I didn't finish, and I didn't get the ride. So, man, that's fate, I guess, you know, one of those deals.
What is it? Everybody has that same story.
Yeah, I've got about 300 of them, but we don't have time. Yeah.
Yeah. Rick New, from the audience, what was your first time at Riverside?
First time, actually, was my dad's scrapbooks when I was a kid, because my dad drove there in 59 for that USAC race. But physically, I drove a McLaren Can-Am car, and it was 1976, and it was a support. They used to have vintage cars run on Saturday, so on the weekends of the LA Times, and I drove an M20, which was the last iteration for McLaren trying to keep up with the Porsches. So that was, needless to say, a rather exciting car to drive there. And we were lucky enough to have Phil Riley help us with the car. And my first pro, then 77, I drove, and Jeff Klein knows this guy pretty well. I drove John Norman's Alfa Romeo, the Slug, in a regional race. And then 78, I drove with Howard Meister because I had done well at Daytona and Sebring and Le Mans. And I ended up driving, it was an Aussie prepared car. And I, like Jeff, have driven just about everything you can imagine at Riverside that has wheels on it, never in a stock car. But I did drive NASCAR a couple of times for the Butt at the Glen because I was a road racer. But I think if one guy we've got to bring up tonight is Les Richter, of course, because I'm a second-generation Northern California driver, and any time you hear about Riverside, which is like Yankee Stadium on the West Coast, wasn't it? I mean, you get everybody there. But they said, just don't screw up, because Richter, you know, and he's a guy that put the NASCAR boys on an annual event starting in 1963. The former L.A. Rams, and hell of a nice guy, but, you know, there wasn't a filter with him in case there was anything going wrong at the track. He'd settle any arguments for everybody. So it was an honor to come to Cal Club, me representing up north, and very fond memories. It's fun to have this show tonight.
Okay. I'm going to need to take a station identification break, y'all. If you don't mind, give me a moment. This is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Warren and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, Spotify. Now reaching millions of fans. Download the app and listen on your phone, car radio, or computer. All right, I have a quick question. Probably be a lengthy mess of answers. Assume you've got some, you're talking to someone that never saw it and doesn't seem to have a grasp of what Riverside was. What made it what it was? Was it the layout? What was it about that track that made it as popular as it was with the drivers?
I kind of saw it.
How about Jeff? You raced there a lot.
Is that a dumb question or what?
No, it's not a dumb question, but I you know, it's like when it was there, it was there. And it was like a spectacular race car and racetrack. And I never really thought, well, what made it so spectacular? But as you said, the layout was amazing that, you know, you'd have this real fast S's going up a hill, and then you had a 180 and then downhill. It was pretty spectacular. I don't know who laid it out, but it was pretty incredible in terms
too.
Of, yeah, it was pretty incredible. The layout was pretty neat. I mean, the location sucked. There was nothing worse than Riverside. You know, it was either, as I think Dave said when we started, it was either cold, raining, or hot and dusty. And I mean, when, you know, it's right near Palm Springs, so hot was hot. And I know a lot of races, you know, you'd be out there in the summer for some of the races, and it would be so hot, it was just almost unbearable. If I hadn't been in my 20s, I probably wouldn't have been able to take it. It was amazing. But the track itself made it all worthwhile. You know, you felt like you were on a real professional venue, kind of like Road America or something. So that's why I liked it so much. It was just kind of cool.
As a corner worker in the summer, Riverside is where I learned ladybugs bite. I didn't know that.
Ow.
I came from Sherman Oaks.
No,
they don't bite over there. And they bite hard. And we'd be standing there on the turn nine wall and flagging Riverside and NASCAR race. And those bugs would bite, man. They were bad. So here comes a watering truck. And they would hose us down. They would turn the water towards us. We'd stand there and just get hosed down for a minute. It was great. Like I say,
it was pretty amazing.
You know, what was it about Riverside? It was everything. The corner workers were having a good time. Racers were having a good time. Spectators were having a good time. It was a good time.
I mean, you know, the city, we couldn't afford to actually stay overnight at Riverside when I was doing club racing. So I'd drive all the way back to Santa Monica and then get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, drive all the way back to Riverside, do that three times or four times over the weekend. And, you know, it was worth it. It was spectacular to go there. And when I was driving for Hyde Park Motors, the BMW 2002s for about 5 years, it was just the place to be that, you know, the cars were, every car that you drove there, whether it was the Renault that was mentioned before or a really fast car, it was just a cool place to be there. I think turn two was kind of a, you know, a kind of a butt sucker, no matter what car you were driving there. And I don't know if everyone agrees, but it was just a pretty cool place to be.
Hello there.
One of the interesting things, and maybe John Dillon might be able to comment on this, are the races that we haven't talked about today, because it's not the hours in the day, include motorcycles and the off-road racing of Mickey Thompson, short course racers, have been huge crowds. Did you guys, any of you corner workers, work at any of those events?
I got a story. I go to a motorcycle race at Riverside. I go up to a registration building. I get my pass. I head towards the tunnel to go under turn one, and I see this motorcycle going, flying through the air. Driver, rider, flying through the air, and I went, wow, that looked bad. And I scramble to the other side, and stop the car, and get out, and run over to the fence, and you know, I've been riding Honda CBXs since they were new, and it was a CBX, and I'm thinking, there's a dip at turn one where it goes over the bridge. There's a dip on both sides of it, and apparently I just launched that bike into the air and watched it sail. I'm laughing because the guy wasn't hurt, and then, you know, so... But it was quite an introduction to what motorcycle racing was going to be at Riverside. It was like, wow.
We used to have a motorcycle race as a prelim to the Times Grand Prix in like 61, 62. And I remember being there in turn five and a guy coming up in the motorcycle, and I was like 17 years old. And he comes up in the motorcycle and he misjudged turn six, dropped the motorcycle, went skidding across the ground, and his feet went under the guardrail. And of course, his face went right into the guardrail, flattened him out just straight out. So they get the yellow flags out. The motorcycles are still buzzing by. They drag the guy out from under the guardrail, throw him in a meat wagon, drive off. And that was the last thing said. You know, it's like incredible. Those guys I thought were incredibly brave. And you wouldn't get me riding a motorcycle out there.
Flying through the air. Wow.
Yeah, how about the off-road races? John Dillon, did you work at any of those?
I didn't work any of the off-road stuff. I was too late to the game. But my first pro race was the NASCAR race at 88, which was the last NASCAR race before they took it up north. And it was a very different experience for me. Up until that point, I'd been doing club racing. And, you know, you could go just about anywhere. You didn't have to deal with the credentials and the crowds. And so to show up for NASCAR was an eye-opening experience. Pretty exciting.
Well, listen, we won't make you sing it, but tell us about the song that Bill Waltrip tried to kill me in the '66.
Yeah. So I was flagging at turn two and back then we had quite a few people there at the station, and I was flagging with Steve Sanders, who was on the blue flag, and suddenly his eyes get really, really big, and he says, "Watch it, watch it." And I'm looking down track towards four and five because I'm on the yellow, and Allison and Waltrip had come together down in turn one, put them off in the dirt, and Waltrip came up, flattened our flag station, because the track was being closed in, it was not a stout barricade, it flattened that. Steve and I ran, kind of did the Keystone Cops move, where we ran into each other, and then we scattered opposite directions, and Waltrip hit the wall behind us, between us, and then he looked over his shoulder, and he motored on down the road. And that inspired the song. I've got the Darrell Waltrip took out my flagging station, but I'm still flagging blues. And I've managed to get it recorded, but it's a friend of mine, along with the flip side, Riverside is closing, and had it for sale at the last lap of Riverside, which was a Cal Club event in July of 88. Steve had mentioned, this is when Waltrip was sponsored by Tide Detergent. And Steve was having a beer with some friends over at an apartment about a week later, and there happened to be one of those little laundromat boxes of Tide sitting on the coffee table. He said it gave him quite a jolt to see that thing. It just suddenly flashed back for a moment. Yeah. And one of our flaggers, he got lightly tagged, and after that, he became a tech inspector.
Oh, Kelly, tell us about your best experience at Riverside. Or maybe your worst experience.
The worst one was watching the Sauber crash, and my trip to Le Mans going away. The best ones were actually at the Riverside, Holiday Inn. They were always interesting. I think finishing second in the IMSA 6 hour race in 79 and again in 81, my two best finishes there. And finished second to Dave Cowart both times. I was with Albert Nayon and Tony Garcia, and we finished at both times. Dave and Kemper had a flat tire. They took the chicken. One more lap, we would have won both of those races. It was really neat. After that race, just being there actually was real neat, actually. So yeah, it's about it for me for memories of that place.
I got one about Riverside. As a corner worker, did you know that Motel 6 was actually $6 a night? because yes. It was on yes. Alessandro, and we stayed there, and it was $6 a night, and we had like 15 people staying in one room. It was normal. Yeah. That was normal. Yeah, that was normal.
And they left the light on for you.
Yes, they did. For $6, what a deal.
That's where it got its name. I think everyone's amazed at that, but that's, you know, $6 then was like $60 now, so it wasn't that outrageous.
It was pretty cheap compared to everything else on University Avenue. We never stayed at a hotel there.
This is Jeff Klein, but I was just thinking at the 86 IMSA race at Riverside, I was supposed to drive with Don Bell, and the car broke before I got in it. And Joe Vardy came over and asked me to drive with him in the Alba Buick that he had. So I drove it a couple stints, and I'm in the pit getting gas, and I'm almost ready to pull out. And we were at the front of the pit when Lynn St. James and Doc had that accident. So it happened like a motion picture right in front of my eyes, because I was maybe 50 yards from it. And it was the most amazing thing to watch from that angle. And anyway, once they got it cleared up and I'm out driving along in the Alba, and I went inside a Camaro at turn three in the S's, and he turned in on me and we bumped. And it was, forget the guy's name, but anyway, the car went off into the toolies to the left, hit the fence, went over the fence, and landed face first on some guy's hood, one of the spectators. And anyway, he broke the guy's leg, and there was a big lawsuit about that and everything. And then I was like kind of the one that started it all, or he turned in on me, however you want to say it. But that was kind of an eventful event. And man, I wish I could remember who. I think Dick Valentine, Richard Valentine, was one of the drivers on the Camaro. But anyway, that was kind of an awful weekend with that crash. So that's my 2 cents of what I remember.
Hey, how about one last round of stories here to finish this up here? Let's Bill Phillips, got any more to say?
You know, somebody mentioned Les Richard. I just want to say that I had several encounters with him, and he was a gentleman. You knew where he stood, and he held his ground, but he always treated us fairly. And I got to tell you, up in the press box, he always provided the best lunches for us.
Yeah, Les Richter was single-handedly made that track work. When you drive in there during the week, you sometimes see him mowing the lawn at his office. And
okay.
I don't think he's doing that with Bill France at Daytona.
Yeah, he went to work for NASCAR as a executive, didn't he, after Riverside closed?
Actually, before Riverside closed, he moved on to work with Ontario Farm and ended up with NASCAR, yeah.
Oh, okay.
But it was, you know, I moved out to Riverside because it'd be close to the track, actually, when I had the Mitsubishi program. And from 1985 on, there was continually newspaper articles. You'll find them in my books, actually. They're moving the track to Corona. They were going to move out to Santa Clarita, a variety of things. And the owner for a number of years was really a developer. So it was no great surprise when it became more valuable before it turned into a shopping center. Unfortunately, the shopping center has never worked very well. Now it's really failing. And you'll see some talk on Facebook, let's tear down the shopping center and build another racetrack. But that'll never happen. So.
Am I not mistaken that Bob Hope owned that land originally?
No, but he was originally one of the financiers, along with William Edgar and a guy by the name of Jim Peterson, who did most of the construction and layout work. And actually, Jim Peterson's XKSS Jaguar is now on display at the Peterson Museum, no relation. But they're about 3 years after it opened, I think about 1960, they were going broke and had to raise some money and get some new financing, and new owners took over. And it never was very profitable. The only thing that made money there were the NASCAR races. And it's difficult, you know, don't invest in racetracks. That should be everybody's motto. And Rick Newt, what's your last word, sir?
Well, it was a fast track, and it had a rhythm to it. It had the topography that Jeff Klein was talking about. You'd get a good shot coming out of turn six, and that chute going into seven, when you'd really hit the binders, you'd put a huge load on the car, and then they would almost spring in the air for that left turn. So I think it, even though it was Riverside and kind of a flat part of California, the way the track laid out brought a lot of diversity, and I truly enjoyed it and had some great finishes there, and I appreciate being on this panel tonight. So thanks.
So I'll tell one last story. Some of you might have been involved in the Firehawk series. In 1985, the first Firehawk race at Riverside, I ran a couple of Mitsubishi Mirage Turbos. We had run them previously at Sebring. And they were pretty fast, but we only go about 45 minutes on a tank of fuel. They just gobbled down the fuel. So with Mitsubishi we were able to come up with a much higher boost and a much bigger gas tank. And in the Firehawk race in 1985, Renelly Jones and Tommy Kendall won overall in a Nissan 300ZX. And we weren't far behind them winning the touring class, or the sports class, I guess it was then, with the Mirage, with the late Ron Cortez and the late Mike Rutherford and me. And Ron kind of showed us the way. If he came off turn nine just right, he could run flat out all the way to turn six, didn't have to lift at one. And it was terrifying. We got to do it. Anyway, after the race, we won. I had all these Mitsubishi people there in a big tent, cars on display. And George Silverman from IMSA came by and shook my hand and said, "Dave, don't ever bring that car back." And that was my last Firehawk race.
I was in that race, Dave, driving a Camaro.
That was a big gas tank.
Dave, I was in that race driving a Camaro. And I think Sterling Moss was in the race, if I don't recall. I'm pretty sure that was the race. And he was driving a Porsche of some sort, of like a 924, 944, whatever they had. And I remember passing him in turn nine, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't believe I'm passing Sterling Moss. This is like the coolest moment of my life, you know. So it was so cool. That was a good race.
Yeah, Sterling was everybody's hero. And, of course, long after he retired from serious racing, he got to drive 944s, particularly in both the Firehawk series and the Escort series. And a number of people said the same thing. I can't believe that I was running nose to tail with Sterling and then passed him. But, again, he was 65 and we were 25. You know?
That seems young to me now.
Well, yeah, maybe. I wasn't 25 even then. Whatever. All right, you guys, listen, this has been a great show. And Trish will tell you all the details.
Thank you. Thank you all for setting this up.
And I thank you all for great stories. And for our audience, thanks for listening. All our shows are recorded. You know where to go. Next month, January 15th, will be a recap of Daytona 24 Hours, past and present, with an assortment of guys and women who were there. Until then, bye-bye from Trish at Race Talk with Trish.